Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley. Today, we have an old friend of mine, Jim Fields. Jim Fields is an American entrepreneur who has spent over 15 years living and building businesses in China. He speaks fluent Mandarin, began his career at Adobe in Silicon Valley, and moved to China where he worked at Nokia and Reckitt before founding Relay Video in 2016, a Beijing-based creative marketing agency that helped Chinese tech companies, including Xiaomi, Tencent, and Lenovo, tell their stories to global audiences. He later founded Relay Club, an influencer management platform for Chinese brands going outbound. He now serves as Chief Growth Officer at Nuon Medical and is involved with Orin Medical, a Shenzhen-based manufacturer within the Kaiyan Medical Group. In this episode, Jim talks about his journey from Silicon Valley to China, what he learned building Relay Video, and the most common mistakes Chinese tech companies make when trying to go global. He explains why he pivoted from marketing into medtech and breaks down both companies he works with today, Nuon Medical, which embeds clinical technologies like red light therapy, microcurrent, and PEMF directly into cosmetics applicators for brands including Clarins, Vegegi, and Orin Medical, which manufactures red light therapy and medical wellness devices with over 300 patents across six FDA-cleared facilities. Jim also discusses his TEDx talk, arguing that light is a fourth macronutrient alongside oxygen, water, and food, the science behind red and near-infrared light therapy, and why he believes it belongs in everyday consumer products. He covers the beauty tech market in China versus the West, how U.S.-China trade tensions and tariffs affect a cross-border business like his, and what he's learned from 15-plus years of building across both markets. Enjoy.
The kind of key idea, I think, to understand, and it didn't really sink in for me either until I started to get into this world of photobiomodulation, is for the vast majority of, you know, human evolution and the lifespan of humans on this planet, we lived outside. Humans, you know, for the vast majority of the time that we were alive, we lived in concert with the rise and fall of the sun. You would go outside when the sun rose in the morning, and actually you'd go to bed at night before the advent of artificial lighting and electricity in the last couple hundred years. When the sun went down, that was kind of it, right? You could do a fire, but you'd essentially go to bed and you'd rise along with the rhythm of the sun. In the last few hundred years, right, with the advent of industrialization, electricity, that all changed. We can stay up much later than we could before because of electronic lighting and all the infrastructure we have. And I think previously when I looked at the world of phototherapy, before I kind of got into it, I thought, oh, well, why is it that people would need to expose themselves to light therapy? It's not so much that this is additive. Your body has this cascade of physical reactions that happen when you're exposed to light. And people, I think, to some extent know about vitamin D, but there's so many other things that happen when you're exposed to all these different frequencies of light that come from the sun, right? The sun shines a white light that's, if you shine a prism, is actually composed of all these different frequencies of light. And all those different frequencies act differently when they're exposed to your skin and your body. When you think about adding light, and not just red light, all these different frequencies of light via medicalized treatment, the idea is not to add something new that wouldn't be there, like as an artificial source. It's actually more about replenishing something that for most of human civilization, you should have been getting already. It's something your body is crying out for. It's something that your body is actually desperately in need of.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Jim, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Todd, thank you so much. I'm very happy to be back here and to see you again.
Let's start with your story. You went from Silicon Valley to Beijing to building businesses in China over 15 years ago. How did that journey unfold and what has kept you there?
There was a very kind of thing, funny thing that happened hundreds of years ago, which is that there was Jesuit missionaries who were traveling all over China attempting to convert people to Catholicism. And so this was actually the genesis of my China story, because in Silicon Valley, growing up, I went to an all-boys Catholic school that was also started by the Jesuits. And there'd been this hundreds of years connection between the Jesuits and China because of that previous missionary work. And so my high school, which was named after St. Robert Bellarmine, was called Bellarmine College Preparatory in San Jose, right next to the San Jose International Airport, had a Chinese language program. And so when I was 14 years old, I started taking Mandarin lessons, continued through high school, and then went to another Jesuit school in Boston, Boston College. And my third year in university, had the chance to come to Beijing in 2009 in the aftermath of the Beijing Olympics, when a lot of the banners and posters were still all around the city in January of 2009. And that was just a very exciting time and moment to be in China as a young American who knew some Chinese. And in the aftermath of that, you know, there was just so much enthusiasm about global collaboration and all the possibilities that existed, a little bit like the vibe you see just in the last few months around the World Cup. And so I was just instantly enamored with China. I went back to Boston, where there was a very limited Chinese presence, but I still really was so amped on China that I would go on the weekends and nights to Chinatown in Boston and force the locals to speak to me in Mandarin, although most of them didn't speak Mandarin. Most of them spoke Cantonese, and was just obsessed. And then I finished my university in Boston, bought the cheapest flight I could find, which it just incidentally took me through Rome. I flew from Boston to Rome, spent 6 hours in Rome, fell asleep with a slice of pizza in my lap, woke up, got on the plane, went to Beijing. And that was 2010 in May. And so now here we are. It's July of 2026. It's been 16 years since that fateful flight. And I've been here ever since. And I'm still loving it, still enamored by all the opportunities that exist in China. And I think it's funny, a lot of folks in the States would ask me, you know, over the years, like, why China, or why do you remain there, et cetera. But in a lot of ways, I remain as excited, if not more excited, about the possibilities that exist here after all this time.
It's going to go down in history as one of the most exciting times to be in, one of the most exciting places that is so transformative globally in so many regards. Even when I was there, because I first landed in 2007. Yeah. And then I left all of 2008, came back at the end of 2008, starting my much longer journey in China in 2009. And then, of course, you know, we saw the advent of the smartphone, right? The iPhone comes out in 2007. Smartphones become really popular. You're watching a billion people in real time get access to the internet a lot for the first time, because desktop computers were really quite financially prohibitive to owning, and sure, they were really just in offices, not something you took home. And then everything took off. And it has just continued to be an absolute wild time. And of course, with EV and AI, it is, I mean, why leave? You're at the crux of, you know, where change is happening. And it's so exciting. It's just hard to give up. It's just really, really hard to give up. So I completely understand why you've stayed.
Totally.
Let's go back to Relay Video. Back in the earlier days, sure, it was built on a specific thesis that Chinese brands are the brands of the future, but they need help telling their stories to go global to audiences. How did you identify that gap? What did you learn about the difference between how Chinese and Western brands communicate?
I think it's a great question. And, you know, in general, it also boils down to like the way that we're brought up and educated. We talked earlier about my experience in school and Catholic school and what I learned there. And as a child growing up in the States, before we started the podcast, you know, you and I were talking about books and reading and literature. We're so taught from a very young age to be focusing on stories and how you tell stories. And then when you move into school, you're also taught about the power of extemporaneous speech and how to present yourself and how to communicate and show and tell in elementary school, and expository speech when you get to high school, and presentations in front of your class when you get to college. And so as a Westerner going through the system, the power of presentation and putting yourself out there and speaking, you know, contemporaneously well in a persuasive way is something that's really baked in, right, to our educational system. And then I think in China, for folks, it's actually seen very differently, right? Where it's more like, you know, a lot of the kind of slick talkers are more seen as kind of hucksters, or as people who are perhaps a little bit, you know, as they would say in Chinese, yoni, a little bit oily, you know, and there's a little bit of like a hucksterism and a bit more of a sense of salesmanship that in some ways is seen as not being very authentic and genuine in China. And if you want to really be a, you know, a real player or a real entrepreneur or someone who's really like making deals, then actually it's more about getting in the weeds and delivering the product as opposed to telling some fancy story. And so when you look at the model of like a lot of successful technology entrepreneurs in China, it's very different than, for instance, you know, like the Steve Jobs model, where they walk out on stage and they give the outstanding keynote and then they, you know, wow people in that way. And that's what drives all the enthusiasm. It's really like delivering outstanding products. And so if you look at a lot of the top CEOs in China, like they are really, really good in terms of their ability to ship products quickly. And, you know, whether it's WeChat, mobile phones, EVs, all the things you talked about, deliver incredible products, but they don't deliver the messages in the same way. And so as someone who came through that tradition of having been a literature major, and then also since I was young, you know, always playing with video cameras and video editing and design and animation, I just realized very early as a bilingual American in China with this storytelling focus that I had this superpower. And so, in 2016, set up my first company, which was Relay Video. And our purpose was initially just working with a lot of these kind of Chinese technology companies and startups that had really cool products, but didn't know how to tell the story for international audiences. And started very small. We were helping companies to do videos on crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. But you know, and you know this, Todd, having been in China, like the thing that's amazing about China is you can get yourself thrust into these situations far beyond your competence. And as so long as you kind of demonstrate that you're able to deliver, incredible things can happen. And so what happened with us at Relay Video is after a few years of having done these small scale crowdfunding videos, I got a call one day, and it was from a friend who worked at one of China's top search engines. This at the time, a company called Sogo that was kind of like Yahoo, a search engine and an online platform. And it was their head of investor relations. And they said, hey, we've got this big challenge, which is we'd like to create an investor roadshow video for our upcoming IPO. Can you do it? And without knowing anything or any context about an investor roadshow or anything about what that was, you know, I took the lesson that I'd already learned at that point in China, which is like, if a big, honking, exciting opportunity that you don't fully understand gets dropped in your lap, like jump in 2 feet first, you know, a bit like that Jim Carrey movie, Yes Man. I don't know if you've seen that movie that came out like 20 years ago. Mike, just say yes. And so we said yes. And that unlocked what ended up becoming like a very crazy 5 years of my life where in very short order, we became the kind of top company to help Chinese companies that were starting in China and wanted to list internationally on stock exchanges in New York and Hong Kong with their international roadshow films. And we worked with, you know, hundreds of innovative CEOs and founders like Popmart, the toy company, Xiaopeng, the EV company, Meituan, the top sort of online e-commerce delivery, food delivery, everything company. And so we worked with all these top companies to create films to help tell their stories to international investors. And it was this whirlwind experience that, again, was the kind of thing that could really only happen in China, you know, to go from starting this little production house and then suddenly, you know, you're in the room with these top CEOs. And I personally would be the guy behind the camera interviewing them to get to learn the stories about how they set up their companies and tell those stories for an international investor audience. So yeah, that was kind of the first big entrepreneurial opportunity I had in China.
Jim, that exact mantra or approach of just saying yes is exactly what changed my life and in China. Yeah. I was, you know, my story was trying to figure out how to not be an English teacher in China. And I was, you know, it was 2009. I was in Dalian in the northeast of China.
Yep.
And I met a foreigner who was trying to do a magazine, which then I ended up jumping in and then taking over and just was beating my head against it. I went through everything, all the ups and downs, you know, all kinds of stuff going on. Did that for a couple of years. And then eventually we had to kind of walk away with our tail between our legs. It was a very tough uphill battle. And I got a call from a friend who had joined a fund and was running something called an accelerator that I could barely spell, much less know anything about. And he told me that they were planning on launching a hardware accelerator in Shenzhen.
Right.
And that he was going to move to Shenzhen and that he wanted me to come in and run the software accelerator called Zhongguo Jiasu or China Accelerator.
Right.
And take it over starting in 2012. And, you know, and work for this venture capital fund. I'm like, I don't know finance. I don't know tech. What, why, you know, what are you asking me for? And it was simply because I had been through the trials and tribulations of being an entrepreneur. I had the empathy and good on them for recognizing that was the key skill that they were really looking for, you know, with the drive and dedication and persistence and all this kind of stuff as well. But that's what they really wanted. They're like, you know, not everybody can do this and do this in China, but you've already done and worked so hard to do this kind of thing here. But anyway, I was scared to death. I had massive imposter syndrome, but I did it anyway. Absolute changed my life. Just an absolute key cornerstone. And I tell the guy, Cyril Ebersweiler, if you're even listening, he changed my life by seeing something in me that I didn't even know was valuable. And then calling me out and bringing me in because of that, when I didn't even believe I had that. And all I had to do was have the courage to say yes and accept it and go for it. So, okay, I digress, but it is for those who listening and who cares, this is, it's a huge, huge thing. I mean, I just can't say enough about how important it is, of what you just said. So,
yeah. And I think also for a lot of young folks, I mean, I get folks who come to me, a lot of people in the United States and other parts of the world who are like asking about China, or people who are, you know, earlier on in their career, and they ask me about these different opportunities, you know. And I think now, especially with AI, people have this tendency to dump all this stuff, context dump into ChatGPT or Claude, and then try to create all these lists of reasons, yes, no, you know, all this pontification, all this analysis, you know. And I think that all the great opportunities I had, it were originating with that, you know, get up and go mentality and just saying yes to these opportunities. And so, and China is just the place to do that, because you can get introduced to these things that would never happen anywhere else in the world. Right. And so, yeah, I would say don't allow the AI, you know, pro con analysis to cloud your thinking. And if you get that kind of opportunity in front of you, go for it.
There are no guarantees in life, but I can say if you're not standing on the train tracks, you won't get hit by the train. Mm-hmm. So you at least have to go take the chance, go rogue, be a swashbuckler and explore and go be somewhere and just where things are happening and be a part of it. And good things can very often happen, like you and I both know. And then you got to work with Relay with names like Xiaomi, Tencent, Lenovo, Garmin. I want to ask you what, you know, before we get into, you know, into the rest of the Nuon and everything like that, what's the one most common mistake that Chinese tech companies make when they're trying to go global? You know, how do you and how would you help them fix it?
The biggest mistake that we see, I think, when it comes to brands and storytelling, particularly for brands from China, is, as we said before, the educational system often focuses on key specifications, you know, STEM, memorization, memorizing thousands of Chinese characters, mathematics, hard science. And those things are all well and good. But it creates this phenomenon for a lot of Chinese entrepreneurs and storytellers when they want to talk about their companies. They focus on specifications. They focus on details. They focus on a lot of the things, you know, the screen is this size, the camera has this many megapixels, the car can, you know, have this drivetrain. And those are all persuasive elements, especially for very technical consumers, right? But if you look at, you know, a lot of, you know, Western branding, American branding, it's really much more about feelings and emotions, and also really much more about the way that the product makes the user feel, right? You sell a certain vision, you know, to think about Don Draper and Mad Men, right? It's always about creating a want in the person from some sort of deep emotional level, as opposed to saying, oh, well, our widget has, you know, this many more units of power than our competitor, or it has this marginal improvement in, you know, feature spec specifications. And so when we talk to a lot of these types of Chinese companies, the core thing that we're really trying to always talk about is another word you used before, which is empathy, right? Who are our users? Who are our customers? And is there a story that we can tell about your company, or a story that we can tell about your product that really resonates? And so, you know, I think that was very true, for instance, when we worked together with Meituan. They have an incredible product if you're in China, right? Like, and it's almost hard to describe to people outside of China because of the extent to which it's just so comprehensive. Because in the West, you have very discrete apps for different applications, right? You have, you know, for instance, your delivery app, which is DoorDash, right? Or Postmates, right? You have other apps for local city services, like, you know, Yelp for seeing local restaurant reviews. And then you have other apps that, you know, for instance, like Lime or other shared, you know, transportation apps, or Uber for getting around. But super apps like Meituan or WeChat, they incorporate so many of those different things all in one place. And so for Meituan, this film, actually, if folks are interested to see it, you can still see this film on the investor relations portion of Meituan.com, their website, where we didn't focus on any of these individual features, right? Of saying, oh, well, Meituan can help you order food, or can help you book tickets, or can help you find, you know, local city services. But we just told us a total story of the day in the life of a person who uses this app and all the different touch points and ways that it can impact your life. And by the time you get to the end of this film, as a viewer, you're like, wow, you know, particularly for folks in the West, like, all I need to do is download this one app and it unlocks all these new experiences that are available to me that weren't before. And from an investor relations perspective, you can look at it and say, well, this app is basically baked into every aspect of someone's life, right? And that's a very persuasive story for investors because, you know, that represents many touch points and opportunities to insert brands and commercialization, et cetera, right? And so I think the big challenge for Chinese brands is think in terms of story, not in terms of features, and get people excited about those emotional possibilities as opposed to just the, you know, the specifications or the little details about the widget you sell.
So you've now made a significant pivot from marketing to med tech, from Relay That's Video right. to Nuon Medical and Orin Medical. So what drew you into the beauty tech and light therapy space? And how did your China background connect all with this new direction?
Yeah. So the story about beauty tech is definitely one that for me was sort of a one that I hadn't anticipated. After we finished Relay Video, we basically around 2021 and 2022 had seen that this whole trend of Chinese companies going global in terms of investor relations had sort of slowed down due to geopolitical changes and changes in the global investment landscape and regulation around IPOs, et cetera. And so around 2022, myself and my co-founder, Sophia, we had a different idea, which was to kind of experiment with influencer marketing. And so we spent a few years toying with this idea of an influencer marketing agent. This was a company that was originally called Relay Club, sort of an extension from Relay Video, to help brands that wanted to do influencer marketing connect better with influencers. And we actually sort of spun up a team and developed some software. And it was ironic because this was like about 2 years before, 2 to 3 years before this more recent push for AI agents that's now become like the kind of hot topic in the tail end of 2025 and 2026. But for a bunch of different reasons, I think our idea was actually premature. Like if we had launched it 2 years later, it's possible it would have worked out, but it didn't fully work out the way that we had wanted. And so as we were sort of wrapping up that software effort, we had recruited some investors along the way who believed in our story and had some ideas about how we wanted to grow in terms of influencer marketing. And one of our investors was a guy who had actually seen some videos that I personally had made and posted on WeChat Video, who was a Dutch entrepreneur named Alain Dijkstra, who himself is a longtime China hand. He's been in China for about 20 years. And he was one of the investors in our software company. And so via him, I sort of got to learn about the world of light therapy and started to visit his offices in Shenzhen as we talked about our influencer project, but also to learn about what he was building in terms of the world of light. And you could also do a podcast with him in the future. He's a person who has an incredible story about his experiences with light therapy and how it's transformed the health of himself, his family members, et cetera. But just seeing the way that he was so passionate about it I started to play with these products and devices myself. And, you know, I even have one with me today, which is one of our sub brands, which is a company called LumaFlex, which is a this is like a one that you can put on your body that can send targeted red light therapy into, you know, for instance, if you have like a shoulder pain or specific pains in the body. And so after seeing the efficacy of these products, I started to get really interested. And then in the tail end of last year, as we were contemplating next moves after the influencer software company sort of concluded, I sat down again with Elaine, who is the founder of Nuon Medical, and we started talking about future possibilities. And he explained to me that he had a thesis, which was this whole photobiomodulation is the technical term for light therapy, was already experiencing tremendous growth because he has a company called Kyan Medical that had already been growing very quickly that he built over the last 20 years. And he wanted to start a new company over the last 2 to 3 years called Nuon Medical, which was taking a lot of the innovations from the world of, you know, his company, Kyan, and then putting them into a new domain, which is beauty packaging. And so right now there's been a lot of traditional form factors for beauty products. I'm sure, Todd, you use as part of your daily beauty routine, including tubes and jars and applicators and droppers, et cetera. So there's all manner of different packaging, right, when you use a cosmetics product. But as of now, all these tools from the world of beauty devices, for instance, in terms of red light for one or photobiomodulation for another, or many other technologies that are in these kind of handheld beauty devices or these very expensive therapies you need to go to a spa or a salon or a dermatologist to do. Alan had this idea, which was take those kind of medicalized experiences out of the spa and the salon, and let's democratize them and let's put them into the packaging that users themselves can actually use when they buy, for instance, a jar. Why not unscrew the lid and suddenly there's a red light therapy applicator directly inside the lid, right? Or perhaps you buy another beauty device that has, you know, a tool like microneedling, some tool that allows this formulation to penetrate further into the skin, or other tools, for instance, like EMS, electromagnetic stimulation to simulate muscles and lift, you know, certain portions of your face. And so all these kind of high-end spa experiences, taking them out of those professionalized domains and giving them directly to people who want to improve their skin and their skin health in the home.
I did want to ask about Nuon Medical. So I, without trying to be redundant, because sure, I think I understand what it is, problems it's solving, tell me how embedding medical grade technology into cosmetics packaging actually works in practice. Mm-hmm. Like you might, you know, factories, the technologies. I mean, I love the idea. How does it work?
The key problem that we're solving is kind of two-sided. So one problem that Nuon Medical solves is for users, right? Which is that if you want to get access to these kind of premium treatment experiences, to date, you'd have to either buy like very expensive beauty devices that you'd use at home, or you'd have to spend a lot of money to go to a clinic or a spa or dermatologist or salon and get on a one-time basis and only do on inside of that spa or clinic. And so with Nuon Medical, the problem we solve for consumers is we can actually take those same technologies and put them in the product packaging for products they're already buying, right? Like for creams and jars and tubes. And suddenly these experiences that have been gatekept by these spas and salons and clinics and dermatologists, you can do them on your own. And so that's the problem solution for individual consumers. And then for brands, there's a totally different problem, which is if you're a cosmetics brand in 2026, you're facing a very, very competitive landscape. There's so many different companies around the world that are all making cosmetics products. And your primary challenge is how do you differentiate from all these other guys? And so you used a keyword earlier, which is about medical grade. The interesting thing about what we do at Nuon is the technologies that we actually insert into these products are all ones that we already have obtained all these global medical certifications for. So there's different global frameworks that govern what's considered to be a medical device. For instance, in the United States, there's a framework from the FDA called the 510K certification. And so what does that mean? It basically means that if you take, for instance, the red light from Nuon Medical, this red light LED applicator, and you put it onto, for instance, the lid of your jar, you can actually make what are called medical claims about the product. So you can say, our product is proven to be able to, for instance, reduce wrinkles, right? Or our product is proven to, for instance, treat specific medical conditions. And then those claims, they can't just be used in your marketing, but they can actually be, you know, for instance, on the external packaging of your product that would appear, for instance, when you go visit an offline retail store. And so if you have 10 products, right, on the shelf, and one of them says, you know, it's FDA cleared, and it actually is proven to have these certain effects, suddenly the end user can look at that and say, wow, you know, like this is something that I really, you know, don't just believe in, but actually is proven to have certain effects. And it's a much more persuasive story to tell to the end consumer. And so for brands, this represents a really great way for them to step out and above their competitors and get access to being able to say things about their product that they couldn't say before because of the addition of these technologies.
I like that. It's a very smart business move. Now, you gave a TEDx talk arguing that light is the fourth macronutrient alongside oxygen, water, and food. That's a bold claim, which is obviously why you got to speak about it at a, you know, in a TEDx. Walk us through the science that makes that case.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's a question for you, Todd. I mean, you've told me a little bit today about your new day to day, but like how many hours a day do you think you actually spend outdoors?
Not that many, not enough. I do golf and I do snowboard, not nearly as much as I would like. And to be fair, this is not what you actually wanted to know or why you asked. I know. Uh-huh. I'm derailing.
It's okay.
I apologize.
No.
But I live in a certain area of the world where being outside is everything. You don't live here because you don't love hiking and being on the beach and being in the boat or being on the paddleboard or, you know, snowshoeing or what have you, right? So I probably spend a little more time outside than the average person, but still, sure. I work in an office most of the time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're already at the higher end, right, of the range in terms of outdoor exposure, right? But the kind of key idea, I think, to understand, and I didn't really sink in for me either until I started to get into this world of photobiomodulation, is for the vast majority of, you know, human evolution and the lifespan of humans on this planet, we lived outside, right? We were in, you know, hunter-gatherer societies and then agrarian societies. And so humans, you know, for the vast majority of the time that we were alive, we lived in concert with the rise and fall of the sun, right? You would go outside when the sun rose in the morning, and actually you'd go to bed at night before the advent of artificial lighting and electricity in the last couple hundred years. When the sun went down, that was kind of it, right? You could do a fire, but you'd essentially go to bed and you'd rise along with the rhythm of the sun. And in the last few hundred years, right, with the advent of industrialization, electricity, that all changed, right? The rhythm of human society changed, and we can stay up much later than we could before because of electronic lighting and all the infrastructure we have. And now it's even worse because we have these, you know, digital devices that work at all hours where we're training our eyes. You know, if you monitor your screen time, like, so many hours per week, dozens of hours per week for a lot of people on screens. And so actually it's been this dramatic change even from, you know, just a few hundred years ago to the way that people are spending so much time indoors on screens compared to being outdoors in light. And I think previously when I looked at the world of phototherapy, before I kind of got into it, I thought, oh, well, why is it that people would need to expose themselves to light therapy? You know, it seems like this is maybe a little woo-woo or a little bit, you know, speculative, or is there hard science behind it? But actually, it's really, it's not so much that this is additive, right? Like, for instance, you should add this into your routine because it has certain effects. It's actually more like your body has this cascade of physical reactions that happen when you're exposed to light. And people, I think, to some extent know about vitamin D, but there's so many other things that happen when you're exposed to all these different frequencies of light that come from the sun, right? The sun shines a white light that's, if you shine a prism, is actually composed of all these different frequencies of light. And all those different frequencies act differently when they're exposed to your skin and your body. And so when you think about adding light, and not just red light, all these different frequencies of light, via medicalized treatment, the idea is not to add something new that wouldn't be there, like as an artificial source. It's actually more about replenishing something that for most of human civilization, you should have been getting already, right? It's something your body is crying out for. It's something that your body is actually desperately in need of. And so that's why I think a lot of people maybe misunderstand phototherapy. They think it's a bit kooky, you know, oh, well, I'll wear this red light mask and have this additive effect. But it's more like because of the changes that have happened in human civilization where we're missing out on this exposure to natural light, suddenly we need to supplement these new sources of light to get the same benefits that actually we would have been getting all along.
Orin Medical is a Shenzhen-based manufacturer, over 300 patents and six FDA-cleared facilities. It's part of the Kaiyan Medical Group. How does Orin fit into the work? What does it tell us about the sophistication of China's medical device manufacturing today?
Yeah, so Orin Medical is one of the several groups that make up our overall company inside of Kaiyan. And you can think of Kaiyan a little bit like, for instance, Alphabet, right, is the parent company of Google, right? Or Meta is the parent company of Facebook. So Kaiyan is represents this family of companies that all have slightly different focus areas. And so for Orin Medical, unlike Nuon that focuses on beauty packaging, Orin is really about this very high-end set of tools and devices that can enable people to really like dramatically improve their skincare and their health through the use of standalone devices. So as we said with Nuon, it's like a combining beauty packaging with, for instance, a skincare cream or formulation or other cosmetic product. But Orin is really just stuff that stands alone. And so I can't disclose any of the specific brands we work with, but on the Orin Medical side, like many of the top, for instance, LED face mask companies in the world are manufacturing their products with Orin. And so it's quite unique because right now I work in Bao'an in Shenzhen, far north of the airport in an area that is very much a factory district. But it's kind of fascinating because on a regular basis, we're visited by our customers who are these very high-end, fashionable, cosmopolitan folks who come from Paris and New York and London and some of the, you know, top centers of beauty and fashion in the world to visit our offices and innovate and create these products. And so I think with Orin, what we're doing is, you know, combining like very best-in-class technology solutions into this world of fashion, this world of beauty, to enable those types of global cosmetic companies or beauty companies to innovate and create devices that people can use for skincare and wellness.
I see this stuff everywhere. It is all over Instagram. It is all like Instagram, especially probably Xiaohongshu as well. It's crazy. I mean, and it does look a little odd, but not in a way that I think. Not in the way that it has in the past. I think somewhere it just makes sense. It actually makes sense when you are actually looking and seeing and watching. For some reason, I think there's some sort of intrinsic calculus that just tells you, yeah, that probably actually works. Obviously, the beauty tech market is exploding globally. Red light therapy, microcurrent devices, LED masks, even for teeth whitening, getting, the mouth guard with the light, with the gel. How mature is this category in China versus the West? And where is China leading versus following in these areas?
So I think that the interesting thing about it is there have been a lot of changes that have happened in the West that have sort of ushered in this rise of people being interested in light therapy. And I think actually a big one is that there's been a lot of the last 5-10 years of people who are interested in things like biohacking, a term you hear around a lot. And also to some extent, I think via some changes that have happened with COVID and medicine, you have a lot of people who are kind of skeptical about like traditional, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and a lot of the existing kind of medical players. And they're saying, actually, all these different solutions that have existed, in the West to date have been about like force you to take a pill or, force you to, for instance, contribute a lot of money for pharmaceutical industries. And people are starting to think, can I take my health into my own hands? And can I think about, personalized therapies? And can I think about different ways that I can kind of take control of my own health and empower myself to feel better and look better? And so I think those macro trends in the West have really driven people to be very interested in finding new ways to do many things, right? Whether it's about diet or exercise. And I think also in terms of biohacking, in terms of photobiomodulation and red light therapy. And so it's been growing extremely quickly in the West, for sure, in terms of people wanting to use it for skincare, health, wellness, also things like circadian rhythm, recovering from jet lag. I mean, there's a long list and a growing list of all these different applications of the technology. So in the West, I think like this is a trend that, as you said, it's everywhere. I think in China, where I am, you know, today, the interesting thing is that a lot of the ideas that exist in, for instance, Chinese medicine, actually are very in line with principles that have later been discovered to be, represented by the benefits of red light therapy or by photobiomodulation. So for instance, if you really read up on Chinese medicine, there's so many different ideas about blood circulation in the body and the benefits of blood circulation. And there's different tinctures and teas and treatments and acupuncture, et cetera, that can all be sort of based on this idea of, you know, your blood circulation and internal heat and internal cooling, et cetera. And I think for a lot of people in the West, for many years, that's all been seen as sort of dubious, right? But actually the world of photobiomodulation and light is that these frequencies of light can actually have effects on your mitochondria and ATP and stimulate blood flow. And so in an interesting way, I think that a lot of the truths that originally began in the world of Chinese medicine are now only now starting to be sort of recognized and reapplied and reinvigorated in this world of red light and in terms of photobiomodulation. And so I think the interesting thing you may see in China is that where the market is going could be actually more in that direction of not just, you know, looking at the way it's done in the West, where you have, you know, like the bro podcast universe of people who are just using red light and saying, oh, you know, it can do X and Y and Z, or, you know, the Brian Johnson biohacking set. But it's possible that the future of, you know, photobiomodulation in China could be something that actually is totally different. It could be more focused on wellness. It could be more focused on holistic medicine. It could be more focused on longevity, right? And so we're starting to see that now. And I think it's an area to look out for because I think any Western brand or company or innovation that tries to come to China on its own terms doesn't always succeed, right? But if you're able to modify and think about the unique insights about the market, I think that there's a lot of opportunity in China if you pivot into this direction of wellness and considering applications related to Chinese medicine.
If you were, say, I don't know, let's just pick it out of a hat, a white male in their early 50s, what would be the number one product that you're aware of now in this world that you would recommend? If you could just, I just got to get one. I want to try using one. What's the number one product you'd recommend?
I mean, these things are all very personalized, right? And so, you know, I think like looking at you now, your skin looks pretty good. I don't know if we've got some filtration happening in the...
not at all.
Yeah. I know so a lot of people are listening to audio, but Todd is glowing right now. He's looking, his skin is looking very nourished and he's looking very, I see no wrinkles. He's looking very good.
I also have like the perfect sun outside right now. It is about 7:30 evening in Canada. The sun is just setting over the hill. You know, it's filtering through the sun blinds.
Magic hour.
The blinds there. It is. Yeah. I'm glowing because everywhere around this place is glowing.
Yes. But I think, I mean, the one that for me has had an impact and, the most actually has been, these kind of circadian rhythm optimizers. And so, we were talking about different frequencies of light before. Obviously red light has great benefits in terms of anti-aging, wrinkle reduction, et cetera. But one area where I've seen a huge benefit for myself is, regulation of melatonin and your circadian rhythm. And so I actually have like a 10,000 lux light that I use in the morning. So you and I were talking earlier about books. You can see many books behind me today. When I wake up in the morning, I read a book. And because I am in a big high-rise apartment in Shenzhen, I don't get direct sunlight exposure, which you hear from, you know, biohacking experts like Andrew Huberman. You should get out and try to get exposed to the sun early. But
first thing in the morning, 10 minutes of direct sunlight.
Exactly. But if you can't do that, then my recommendation is get a daylight simulating light. You can look these up online. And when you're doing your morning routine, like having a coffee or doing your skincare routine, if you can expose yourself to that very bright source of light, it basically tells your body to wake up and it signals to your circadian rhythm to kind of activate all these systems. And there's cortisol and other cascade of reactions that happen. And this also creates this knock-on effect where by the end of your day, because you have this spike of energy and cortisol, et cetera, in the beginning. By the time you get to the end of your day, your body is signaling that it's time to go to bed, right? And so if you can time those things directly, the application of light as part of your circadian rhythm, it can be very good in terms of your overall routine. And as we talked about before, you know, light is something that actually for most of civilization has been a given, right? Because we're outside. But if you're living indoors and you're not exposed to natural light, using these types of tools to get back in that natural rhythm can be a very powerful thing.
Yes. Sleep and waking up. Non-medical, proven through time. I think most people that I know that are very, very healthy, one of the biggest consistencies with their physical health over others is great ability to get a great high quality sleep. And circadian rhythms are a big, big part of that. You know, then you talk about jet lag and, you know, people who, you know, take a melatonin to try to jump right back into the rhythm. Huge. I agree. Okay, thank you. You've operated across two very different worlds. I want to speak more directly even to the negotiation podcast, you know, listeners, just anxious to do business in China in every way, which shape or form. Marketing for Chinese tech brands going outbound and now building a Western-facing med tech business with Chinese manufacturing at its core. How do the U.S.-China trade tensions and the tariff environment affect what you guys are doing today?
Well, the tariff environment, you know, is always something that we keep an eye on. When some of these things started to sort of crop up over the last several years, we made a few moves in order to insulate our business from the effect. So we actually have a fully functioning factory in Delhi with about 140 people. And so this is a parallel operation to our central factory, which is in Shenzhen, where we can manufacture all of our products and do so at a very high standard of quality with all the same medicalization and standards that we would also apply in China. And so what does that mean? It means that if there are any tariffs that are applied by our political administration in the United States, for example, now, that we can insulate from that because we can manufacture elsewhere and thereby allow the brands we work with to diversify their supply chain, right? But I think in general, like, yes, these things have an impact, but at the same time, you know, China has incredible strengths in terms of supply chain that are really not easily replicated in other parts of the world. And so we'll, I think, continue to see China being a place where, you know, companies are going to continue to want to place their primary manufacturing because of the workforce here, because of the tooling engineers here, you know, because of the incredible economies of scale that exist here. And so, yes, I mean, I think for us, we have found ways to insulate companies from these kind of bits of geopolitical turbulence, but we're still very bullish on China. We're still very bullish on the manufacturing environment here. And we don't fundamentally see tariffs as a big impediment to our business.
For entrepreneurs or executives thinking about building businesses that span China and the West, what is the most important thing you've learned from 15 plus years of doing exactly that?
Yeah, I think this is a question in and of itself that could be a whole book. You know, there's been people who've tried to do that, right? Write the ultimate China book and summarize all the things that people need to know.
It's the reason this podcast exists entirely is because it's really, really hard. It's very difficult. We like to talk to a lot of different brands. And then we talk to people like yourself who've been on the ground, boots on the ground, doing it for long periods of time there, working with top brands, understanding the difficulties, watching the successes and failures, and the ever-changing geopolitical environments. But, you know, and I think I'm just talking right now, I'm filibustering my own question to give you time to think about what answer you might want to give. What's the most important thing you've learned and best advice that you'd want to give?
I think the most important thing that anyone who's considering coming to China can do is to cast aside your assumptions and attempt to learn as much as you can from local people or people who have deep, deep experience in market and listen to things like this podcast. But also to take whatever thesis you have about the market you're going to bring to China and really test it by any kind of like, you know, MVP type exposure you can to smart people on the ground who are physically in mainland China who have like deep domain experience, because there have been legions of Western companies that have attempted to come to China and failed. Right. We all know the stories. You know, there's Home Depot is one of the most famous examples. That's also in the realm of home renovation, something that Todd, you know well.
Yeah.
Where companies would say, oh, there's, you know, the billion consumers now, 1.4 billion consumers in China. We access, you know, even 1% of that market and we're going to be, you know, trillionaires. Right. But the reality is in China, people don't go to Home Depot, right? And they spent, you know, tremendous amounts of time and capital trying to scale and they failed, right? At the same time, there's been Western companies, even now in 2026, who've achieved tremendous success in China against the narrative that, you know, I think there's a bit of a narrative now of like Starbucks, you know, for instance, being sort of uprooted by Luckin or other Western companies that are being sort of challenged by local Chinese players. But at the same time, there's other Western companies who are just absolutely crushing it. Like Sam's Club is a example that I talk about a lot. I'm a huge fan of Sam's Club. No sponsorship relationship here to Sam's Club, but Sam's Club is, you know, an extension of Walmart. And that's not a retail operation that I go to much as a person in the States. But in China, Sam's Club is outstanding. And like I would buy now 80-90% of my groceries from Sam's Club because their supply chain is excellent. The quality of their food products is excellent. And they've managed to create an experience that's like extremely in line with the consuming behaviors of people in China and rapidly expanded as a Western company in China in 2026 against, you know, the trend lines that say that, you know, Western companies are sort of challenged or may challenge or struggle to operate in this market. And so I really would push strongly against this idea that Western companies can't succeed in China or Western companies shouldn't come to China in 2026 or, you know, these types of narratives. I think that if you have a great business that you believe in and you test the thesis against the behaviors and the way that people operate in China, you can achieve incredible things. And there's brands that continue to do that day in and day out. And so, yeah, keep listening to The Negotiation, keep listening to Todd, talk to smart people who know the market and, really test your ideas. And if you do those things, you can do very well.
Be humble and use a Sherpa.
Yep.
If you're a brand, you know, and go in and open your ears, shut your mouth. Yes. You've done amazing things in the rest of the world. This is different. So a lot of things might have to change that you didn't think would have to change. But if you're open to it and you're ready to settle in for the ride, amazing opportunity. Now, just a couple of white dudes talking about beauty over here. Jim, yeah. It's been a great conversation. For listeners who want to follow your work, learn more about Nuon Medical or Aura Medical, where can they find you?
Yeah. So I think the best place is actually on Instagram. So you'll see yours truly representing our brand. Just search for Nuon Medical, N-U-O-N Medical on Instagram, where we post about a lot of our new innovations and technologies, nuonmedical.com. And then for myself, anyone who wants to reach out, feel free to reach out on LinkedIn. My name is Jim Fields. And anyone who's just keen to talk about, you know, light therapy, biohacking technology, go to market, all the things that we spoke about today, more than happy to connect.
I know you got to get ready to go on the Huberman Lab podcast up here next.
Right.
Andrew,
that's right.
If you're listening, get them on. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, buddy. Everybody, that's Jim Fields, Chief Growth Officer at Nuon Medical. Thanks for joining us on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Todd.
Thanks to everybody who's listening. We really appreciate it so much. So we would also love if you like or subscribe or interact so that the algorithms can help get our show and all this amazing information out to more people. If you want to reach us, feel free to reach out. podcast@wpic.co, guest recommendations, or even just beauty tips for myself. I will always take those as well. But from me, from Jim, and from everybody at The Negotiation, thanks very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.